welcome to Culture Fly on the Wall, a podcast in which we only talk about football. Incredible scenes in Russia. Simon, you know, because you saw all of it every game.
Well,
you've been on holiday for at least 6 or 7 months now, so you can talk us through every kick, every pass, every goal, every Harry Kane.
I conceded. I did watch a couple, well, a few of them.
I got enraptured into the nail on the head. Okay, so just give us a brief insight into what you saw.
People were scoring, and then they lost. And then ultimately they lost pretty badly.
Let's not talk about football. Seems like you don't have the cognitive capacity to do that.
No,
instead, we'll review Incredibles 2.
And then we're going to do our streaming recommendations. So what you can watch right this moment.
There's Sapiens by Yuval Noah Harari.
Wow, a big deal and definitely one to read. The On the Wall exhibition at the National Portrait Gallery in London. The Michael Jackson exhibition, which is on at the moment.
Some Edinburgh shows that we'll talk about. Although we haven't been to Edinburgh, they will be in Edinburgh.
Oh, yes.
We have seen them in London.
And finally, the first Purge.
Of course, don't forget about Sounds and Sorcery.
Of course. Sounds and Sorcery. Fantasia, if you like your Disney as well, is part of that.
Okay, but people who don't like Disney, who like Pixar, Incredibles 2, straight after this. The Incredibles was an incredible hit for Pixar, and we've waited a long time for a follow-up. I haven't waited, I didn't really like it, but Simon, you did. Here is the follow-up. They've called it imaginatively The Incredibles 2. What's going on?
Okay, so it's kind of weird. Considering the last film was in 2004, the new one is set very shortly after the last film. So no gaps.
Well, that's lucky because you're using people's voices because it's an animation, so they don't really age, I guess.
Yeah, but surely the kids would and stuff. Yeah, but maybe. But it all works very well. What is kind of so basically the plot is in this one: you've got a brand new kind of business kind of man who's kind of after the Incredibles. He wants the superheroes to be legal again. If you remember in the previous film, superheroes were supposed were illegal. They weren't allowed to be around, but they want to be this guy wants them to be legal again.
Okay, so we got the family, the Incredibles, including Elastigirl and Mr. Incredible. I imagine there's some kind of schism between the patriarch and the matriarch. What did you think? What happened? What for you? Were you emotionally moved?
I really enjoyed it. I think in the first instance, you've got a quality of animation that Pixar deliver, which is just magnificent. Just when you watch this film, you realise how the details, right down to the scuffs on their clothing, the kind of slight little burn and singes on each little element, every little bit of mud on them. It's just incredible that you're watching something which is completely digitally animated. So on that level alone, it's a magnificent experience just to go through.
Okay, so technically it's good.
Yeah.
But what about creatively? What about the storyline, the plot, the characters?
Well, my issue always with the first film was that it was just a very standard, conventional family, you know? Mum.
But they had superpowers.
They had superpowers. But, I mean, it was in a world where everybody had superpowers. So, well, not everybody. A lot of people had superpowers.
Frozone, of course.
Luckily, he's in this, and he feels like he's in this a lot more than he was in the previous film.
Great.
But it's much more about Elastigirl, who's the mum of the family, and her kind of story this time, which, do you know what? It was way more interesting. And then, even then, Mr. Incredible, his whole kind of character arc is very interesting as well. He's now at home looking after the kids, and it kind of challenges what that is and what that should be, and how he can be a good husband to a good father to within his family. It's clever because the whole time I'm watching it, I'm thinking, oh, you know, they're tackling some quite sensitive issues here, but they do manage to do it very carefully and sensitively. It's
so
very well
done. It's still family friendly.
Oh yeah,
but it's also 2 hours long.
Yeah. I mean, I guess there is an element of that it does go long. You know, it's it's whether you like the film or not. I mean, I liked it, so I was quite happy to be in it for as long as it was. It kind of changes direction in, at different points. So, you know, what begins the film very sharply takes different turns. And that's kind of exciting because you don't know where it's going to go. You don't know where it's going to end. But yeah, I enjoyed it.
And you feel when it does end, there's space for number three, and they're not going to wait 15 years to do it.
They've got Jack, who's the baby. So as the trailer shows, his superpowers are kind of exciting, shall we say, and that he is one of the most the funniest part of the film is when you see Jack and his powers and how that, you know, perplexes the family around. But
I'm glad there's some humour in it.
Yeah. This is it. I mean, I think the humour works. I think even Edna, who I was not a massive fan of in the first film, Edna was that kind of fashionista woman.
Played by the director Brad Bird.
That's right, yeah. And yet here in the sequel, it's just, I don't know, it's fascinating. Really funny stuff.
Okay, and what about the villain?
So the setup is the Screen Slaver, but again, you know, you don't know who it is, you don't know who their face is, so you're kind of excited about who it could be. And like I said, the plot turns quite sharply. Even when we find out who the Screen Slaver is, I think you're only about halfway in the film.
Oh, brilliant. Okay, so overall, it feels like a recommendation for sure.
Yeah, especially considering when I thought of the first Incredibles, I never put it on such a high pedestal. I do think this kind of rights a lot of the wrongs in the first one, so I really enjoyed it.
Okay, that's The Incredibles 2 from Pixar, and it's on release now.
So you're at home and you're thinking, how do I go to the cinema? You don't have to go to the cinema in this modern day and age. You can just stream it, which is why we've got streaming recommendations, haven't we, Joe?
Yeah, I'm going to start with the new series of Glamorous Ladies of Wrestling, a.k.a. GLOW. It's a second series. The first series did very well, 10 episodes. Kind of a bit of a comedy drama, very female-led, because they are ladies wrestling. Except for Mark Maron, who is like the coach slash director slash general dickhead who's trying to keep him, you know, on target for producing the show, but also dealing with his own personal problems. And they're back. Yeah, Alison Brie is there, Betty Gilpin, and Kate Nash turns up.
Kate Nash?
Yeah, from Foundation.
Rock and roll.
And she's one of the wrestlers. And I really enjoyed the first series. It really built to a crescendo. They got the show on air. They were all having a great time despite the difficulties they had. They overcame their demons, so to speak. And here we are, second series. We're introducing some new problems. And Mark Macron has been an even more of an idiot. But the women are getting it done. So really, I'm excited to finish the series and really worth getting on board with.
So that's GLOW Series 2, and it's on Netflix.
What are you enjoying at the moment, Simon?
I'm going to go to a flash to the past. We're going to be talking about Mitchell and Webb and Peep Show. And if you didn't know, it's all on Netflix, every single series, Series 1 to 9. Now, funnily enough, I watched the first two series probably about 3 or 4 times. I probably watched the third and fourth and fifth series twice, maybe. And then I just bailed. I think I just got a little bit lost.
What a rubbish fan.
No, well, turns out, then I started re-watching it when it was on Netflix, because you can download it on your phone, and you can watch it on the train. And I was like, I love Peep Show. Peep Show's really good.
It's the longest running Channel 4 sitcom of all time.
Well, but the more I watched it, then I told my wife, and she obviously used to watch it, but we never finished it. So we then got into it, and we watched it very quickly, all the series, straight through, which is on Netflix. Peep Show is worth revisiting. If you bailed at one point way back in the noughties, go back. It's a lot of fun.
Well, a new Channel 4 show, which I'm really enjoying, is 8 out of 10 Cats Does Countdown. They're mashing up two shows, and they've started the new series with an all-female special in celebration of 100 years since the suffragettes got the vote for women. So brilliant. So you've got Catherine Ryan hosting it, you've got Lolly Adefope and Sarah Pascoe on one team, you've got Jessica Hines and Roisin Conaty on the other team, of course you've got Susie Dent doing the words, and Rachel Riley doing the numbers. So there's ladies there, and then also Morgana Robinson as Natalie Cassidy. That's a hilarious, just overall the show is hilarious, you know, it's always funny, but all these women bring their A game, and I really enjoyed particularly Morgana Robinson as Natalie Cassidy. So I would say check out all of 8 out of 10 Cats Does Countdown, but particularly this new special episode, All Gals.
Okay, and that's all on 4OD, of course, 8 out of 10 Cats, Channel 4. Then we've got Paddington 2, ooh, which is now on Amazon Prime. So some
for
of you...
For free?
For free, ka-ching, yeah. You get your Prime Day delivery, and then you can also watch your Amazon Prime. And Paddington 2 is now on the Amazon Prime service. And, I mean, if you haven't seen it already, it's a wonderful film. I mean, it didn't get great traction in America, ridiculously, but there is a reason why you're getting all these films coming out with these little fluffy characters. You know, Paddington 2 and Paddington are the reasons behind it. And Paddington 2 is a very successful sequel. In particular, Hugh Grant is...
Reinvented.
Oh, my gosh. Hugh Grant is incredible in it. Hugh Grant is becoming one of my favourite people to watch at the moment. It's weird. He's doing some really cool stuff, really interesting roles, way better than back in the 90s. I'm sorry, Notting Hill fans. Paddington 2 is where it's at.
Okay.
It's on Amazon Prime now.
And those are the streaming recommendations.
Here's a little song to help you get along. Gets you out the door to do a tiny chore.
Simon likes to spend his commute listening to books. Not a big fan of the reading, that's fine. Most recently, Sapiens by Yuval Noah Harari. A really interesting psychological look at the history of humans, I would say. What are you saying?
That's right. I mean, this is a book which was recommended to me a while ago, and I thought, okay, you know, sure, I'll just take your recommendation. But believe me, my mind was blown. It is one of those books where every piece of nonfiction that is thrown your way, you're kind of like, I want that information in my brain so I never forget it, because it's just so dense. There's so many interesting nuggets of history in there.
Can you give us some of those nuggets now?
Okay, I've got a few.
Okay, come on, bring
it. So first off, there was a period where there were like Homo sapiens, which is like us, Homo Neanderthals, which are like big, chunkier, strong versions of us, and Homo erectus, which were like slender versions of us. But ultimately, we were like different species of these kind of versions. We could all like make out together, but it would be like different dog breeds, you know? Whereas now, it's just like Homo sapiens. So there's this weird theory about like, how did it all become Homo sapiens? And either, well, we killed them all, or we like made out with them all, and then we kind of, you know, reproduced and all became Homo sapiens from that. And
that's just... Crikey. That's in-depth.
Mind blown. Period. Okay. Yeah, there's another one. Here's another one, okay? So polytheism, it basically means believing loads of gods, was all the rage back in the old Greek and Roman times. And we all kind of mock that a little bit now, don't we? Like, because it's all about just one god. If you're like Christian, it's just one god. If you're like Islam, it's just one god. It's just this one god thing. Whereas reality is, if you're a Catholic, you'd sometimes pray to different saints for different things, which is kind of you're praying to these different gods. And if you think there's a Satan, which is like another, then that's not monotheism, that's kind of duotheism, and that's very different again. So, you know, it's kind of the same thing. It's kind of evolved as well.
So you feel like you've got the whole of human history, the history of Homo sapiens, at your fingertips.
It's just incredible. I think when you see history read in this fashion, with this information, you get this much better idea about humans and what our potential is, but what our shortcomings are. Like, we don't realize, like, there was a period where there was this agricultural revolution where people were kind of beginning to starting to farm in their fields, and wheat became all the rage, and, you know, our kind of wandering and gathering and, you know, wandering the plains and stuff kind of came to an end because of that, because we just set up and had our little farms. But we didn't know any better, and we kept doing this for years, and it wasn't actually very good for us. But we did it because there was no history books. There was no, you know, after a few generations, then nobody'd know any better. So we just kept doing it. And that's kind of part of now our history. It's just crazy.
Okay, well, all the knowledge now contained in those books. Incredible scenes. Other incredible scenes. Those created by Michael Jackson.
Wow, yeah.
In the 80s. And of course, you know, into the 90s, more and more different. He changed a lot. Let's say that. There's now an exhibition called On the Wall at the National Portrait Gallery. It's then going to tour the world, But here it is in London. Simon, you're obviously a big Michael Jackson fan.
Big
you're,
Dan.
You're an
big
art
Dan.
Teacher. And here you are combining those two loves in one exhibition. You must have been in heaven.
Man, you know, okay, if you're a Michael Jackson fan, you're going to love it on the basis that you see those Andy Warhol prints. You'll see the Dangerous album cover, the original acrylic painting, or is it an oil painting, I think? But the original painting of the Dangerous album cover is there as well. So there's those little nuggets, which are very interesting. But there's another side of it, which is it often shows things which were inspired by Michael Jackson. So sometimes after the fact, and sometimes in no real connection to him, and definitely not okayed by him, because they can be quite critical. So it's just this fascinating kind of deconstruction of, you know, the legend that is Michael Jackson.
I mean, when you talk about Andy Warhol, of course, we talk about pop culture, and Michael Jackson is a perfect pop culture figure, both the positive and the negative.
Yeah.
You know, the way he presented his own image, the way other people took his own image, and now after his death, the way that people are looking at him, the way that fans remember him, the way that people who are critical of him remember him. It's an amalgamation of many different images, and here they are on the walls of the National Portrait Gallery.
Yeah, I mean, there's so many interesting questions about it. For me personally, I picked up the book because I love the idea of this one figure stimulating all these other art pieces even further more than that. One particular piece which I really enjoyed was a piece by an artist called Candice Bretz, and this is an artist called, this piece was called King, a portrait of Michael Jackson from 2005, and it's a 16 channel video, lasts the full duration of the length of the Thriller album, and it's basically 16 people singing independently to the Thriller album in these separate videos. You have to see it to kind of be enraptured by these fans who love it so much they know every single song lyric, but at the same time you don't hear a single bit of Michael Jackson. You just hear these people singing and dancing and moving, and it's infectious. I was in that room for a good 20 minutes because I was just like enraptured by, you know, these people who just love Michael Jackson and just were just singing his stuff. It's an incredible exhibition.
Wow. Well, I'm a Michael Jackson fan as well, so I will be going to that exhibition and seeing if I feel the same way as you. It's definitely a recommendation, isn't it?
Oh, absolutely, absolutely. If you're a Michael Jackson fan, even more so. So tonight, gotta leave the 9-5 up on the shelf. Last year, Joe went to the Edinburgh festivals. This year, he's not. But he is seeing, and I've seen actually, a few of those comedians and those artists who are kind of going to be appearing this year at the Edinburgh Festival. First up, Joe, who have we got?
Okay, so it's a theatre production called Other People's Teeth from Want the Moon Theatre Company. It's a very small piece. There's only 3 or 4 characters in it. Very small theatre company, very small theatre. I saw it above the Old Red Lion in Islington, and it'll be in the Aquila venues, CC venues at Edinburgh. It's one of those classic kind of 60-70 minute theatre pieces. There's the mundanity of an awkward romance against the violence of people being contract killers. Kind of mash those up. It's an interesting piece. You know, there are random tangents. The script is well done. I was disappointed by the lack of imagination in the set and lighting. But overall, it's an interesting piece, and it's one of those things that I'll miss not going to Edinburgh, seeing, you know, kind of young, hungry theatre companies starting out with something a bit random and weird. So, you know, that's Other People's Teeth, and it's by Want the Moon Theatre Company.
Okay, Tom Ward is a comedian who's going to be appearing at the Edinburgh Festival, and we managed to see him last night at the Top Secret Comedy Club or just off Leicester Square. He was really great. He was only a short act. He came on immediately, making everybody laugh with what he's wearing.
Yeah, he had that whole weird like Beatles/Oasis/Blur haircut. He made fun of himself in that sense. He used sound really interestingly.
Yes.
Like he distilled Prince songs down to just one sound and then compared them. And that was really funny.
I was anticipating more of that. And I almost imagine that maybe he has got a few more of these kind of skills up his sleeve. I hope so. And that might be something part of a larger set.
He had some surreal one-liners that were quite impressive. And also, he was a little bit of audience interaction. There was a Hendo in the front row that, you know, kind of tried to dominate proceedings. But he also asked the audience, who here doesn't have a smartphone? And I was the only one
who was able to say yes.
That was a nice little tangent that he did. I enjoyed that bit, yeah, very much.
Yeah, and we only saw a short element of him, but of the night there are four acts, and he was by far the best act of the night. So that's Tom Ward, and he's at the Edinburgh Festival this year.
And of course, one Edinburgh tradition that I always see is Ostentatious.
Of course,
an improvised Jane Austen novel. This year, I'm not going to Edinburgh, but I did go to the Savoy Theatre in London's West End. They've managed to secure a one Sunday a month play there. And I saw their last one before they go to Edinburgh. And it turned out to be Ocean's 5, The Bennett Sisters and The Marine Heist. A lot of fun.
It's a really funny one, isn't it, Ostentatious? Because you kind of think they always make it up on the day. It's all improvised. So, the ridiculous of their work is very much a part of what they do, but it's just like, we don't know what they're going to be like. It's exciting.
Yeah, and I always enjoy it, I have to say. I mean, you know, it's a great cast. You've got Cariad Lloyd in there, Joseph Morpurgo, Charlotte Gittens, Amy Cook Hodgson, Rachel Parrish, and Andrew Hunter Murray, who all have side projects and who, while they're in Edinburgh, will be doing solo shows or other shows as well. So they're very busy people. But I would say, you know, this show in particular, there were only six of them in the cast and they had to do five Bennett sisters. So that added some complications. It was a kind of organised chaos. There was a Lord Stringfellow character, as you can imagine.
Uh-huh.
There's a bit of gay marriage. It was a day after Pride. And there was a Miss Heist, who was the lead character, up against the Bennett sisters. So a really interesting take on Jane Austen. I would say it's definitely affectionate improvisation.
Wow. Well, that's Ostentatious. And the other two recommendations, all at Edinburgh Fringe Festival this year, is Tom Ward and Other People's Teeth by the Want the Moon Theatre Company. Among the first five Disney films is Fantasia, part of the Big Five. And it was Walt Disney's idea about getting classical music to the masses, because it wasn't necessarily accessible way back then in the 1940s. But now, here we are in 2018, and in the vaults, running from the 3rd of July until the 30th of September, is Sounds and Sorcery, which is a kind of live experience celebrating Disney Fantasia. And Joe, you managed to see it?
Yeah, I think you would call it an immersive audio experience. Maybe that's what they call it.
Okay.
Basically, the vault is underneath, there's lots of rooms underneath the Waterloo Station.
Oh, yeah.
They're kind of dank and dingy, but they've been set up to look like sets from Disney's Fantasia. And then you wear a headset, which is connected to music, so when you move into different rooms, the music change, the classical music changes, and you're experiencing scenes from Disney's Fantasia, but not in a cinematic sense, although there are video installations, but more in an art installation. That I would say is the size of it. It is quite weird and a mixture of film and audio and art. But it is, yeah, all linked to Fantasia, which I have to say, I don't think I've watched for a very long time, maybe since the 1940s.
It's famous, obviously, for the Sorcerer's Apprentice, with the whole...
Yeah, and there is that scene, and there are actual human actors in that scene, and they do splash with real water, as I found out, sitting in the front row.
Oh.
It's not the best part of the experience. You do recognize it and you do feel like there's some magic and the lighting is very good, but actually the level of splashing, I would say, and also the movements are not quite synchronized. It's not as magical as it is on film, and it's certainly not Mickey Mouse.
So there's kind of a clear effort at kind of moving away from maybe the Disney animation and just focusing on the kind of feel of music and the colour and that type
of
thing.
Yeah, yeah. And, you know, there's a volcano erupting in one room.
Did you see dinosaurs?
Interesting. Didn't see dinosaurs. Saw a dinosaur egg. I mean, you can explore it at your own pace. I think we spent a couple of hours in there. And, you know, the last scene was a kind of a man made of flames on a TV screen. Didn't really work for me. They were still working out, and actually the sound connection wasn't perfect either. It was a bit clicky. You know, interesting set. Good for kind of sitting down and thinking about Fantasia. Some quite beautiful moments. Maybe good for a date or something, and maybe the opportunity to rewatch Fantasia and think about what Disney was trying to achieve in the 1940s, but doesn't really fit. I mean, it's an impressive site, impressive sets, but for me, didn't really move me and in the way that I was hoping.
Did he use the space well, even? I mean, it would be
considering... Yeah, no, a lot of different rooms, and, you know, it was never too full of people. So, you know, you could experience rooms, at your own pace. Right. So that was nice. But, yeah, and there was a few human performances, but they were just a bit, a bit off. It was a nice forest effect at one point, forest of lights.
Would you bring kids?
No. I think it's a bit dark and dingy to bring kids. That's a no from me. Overall, just a bit disappointing. But if you're big into Fantasia, if you've watched Fantasia recently, I think you'll go in and maybe connect with it a bit more and connect with the idea a bit more.
Okay, so that is Sounds and Sorcery, which is at the Vaults at the moment, under Waterloo Station, is that right?
Yeah, absolutely.
And that's running until the end of September. So I'm a bit of a weird completist. Whenever I see a film, I always kind of feel like I need to watch all the other ones. But when you have a film like The First Purge, where it's a prequel to the series, it's kind of the starting point of how the Purges came along, I'm sure there's a very clever option for people who are new to the series to watch it and start maybe their interest in The Purge. Joe, you are one of those people. What did you think? What is The First Purge? What is it all about?
So, The Purge is a series of horror films based around the concept that for one night in a year in America, or for 12 hours, crime is legal. So you can do what you want. You get all the crime out of your system, you purge it, and then you don't commit crime for the rest of the year. That's what I got from The First Purge, having not seen any of the other purges. That's the architect of the principle behind The Purge. So it's a horror film, but it's also a kind of reflection on our time, you know, troubled times. And that's why I thought The First Purge would be like a look at how The Purge got started, because obviously the later films in the series are when The Purge has been perfected. So here we are right at the beginning. What's the purpose of The Purge? And how do people react to it in the beginning? And then maybe I'll delve into the series and see how they react to The Purge later on down the line.
So you were very much of a mindset that this might be your hook in. You're interested by the subject matter. Now is your opportunity to be pulled into the series and watch them every time they're released. Are you now a fan?
No.
Okay.
So it's kind of chaos, which is what you would expect The Purge to be.
Yeah.
It doesn't really explain the rules of The Purge, which I guess they're kind of feeling their way through, like, oh, what can The Purge be? There's a lot of kind of mysterious psychological, oh, what does it mean if this happens? And then, of course, it becomes a political tool for the new founding fathers of America who have the presidency in this alternate universe. And they're testing it out on Staten Island. And, of course, this is full of low-income neighborhoods. I will say, so Marisa Tomei is kind of the psychologist who's saying, this is an interesting experiment that I have proposed. I don't want it to be used for political ends. She's really bad. And at one point she says, in relation to The Purge, what have I done? But I think she might also be saying it about being in the film.
Wow, that's a shame. Do you think you're even interested? Would you be interested in watching The Purge films now?
And maybe I'll get into the other Purges. Certainly, it has slightly piqued my interest. The problem here is that, like with that Marisa Tomei line, a lot of the dialogue is very on the nose. You know, it's very clear what's happening. There's no real satire to it. There's a lot of characters and subplot. A lot of violence and it's not, there are a few jumps, but it's not really a horror film. It's more of an action film, particularly when Dimitri, who's played by Yolande Knoll, who's a local drug dealer, but you know, with a heart of gold, of course, he has to raid a tower block, and it becomes like The Raid. It's basically him against these Nazis, and that's, yeah, it's not really a horror film in that sense. The best bits I liked were when you got the kind of the footage of people in their masks, which were obviously a big part of the Purge, big part of the marketing, you know, and these creepy anonymous moments where people are committing crime just for the sake of committing crime rather than to secure a political end. But I will say it's a disappointing film. There are too many characters, too much subplot, and in the end, not enough hard-hitting horror or satire.
All right. Okay, that is a shame. I was curious. I was definitely interested with the momentum of the series and the fact that they're going back to this first Purge, but it looks like that is not a recommendation. But nevertheless, that is the first Purge, and it is at cinemas now. Your mission, should you choose to accept it. But should you choose to accept it? Mission Impossible's coming soon. You going to be watching it, mate?
Yeah, mate. In IMAX, mate. What about you, mate?
I will be watching it big time. I've been watching all the other ones in advance.
I'll watch Rogue Nation in advance. Alec Baldwin. Wow.
You love Alec Baldwin?
Yeah, he's great.
Who is better? Alec Baldwin, Anthony Hopkins, and
Billy Crudup,
here we go.
Who's the first one?
Well, Jim Phelps.
Oh, yeah, well, okay.
John Voight.
No, obviously it's Alec Baldwin, yeah.
Yeah, I think Anthony Hopkins is the worst.
Oh, Lawrence Fishburne gets a wee bit.
Lawrence Fishburne is nice. Okay. Yeah, shame he didn't turn up again.
Angela Bassett is in this new one as a, you know, there's something going on. Henry Cavill is obviously working for her.
Yeah.
I don't know, there's a lot going on.
I really hope some of these people come back. Which one do you want to come back the most? Well, Jonathan Rhys-Meyers.
Oh, no. Kerry Russell is dead, isn't she?
Oh, yes.
Maybe she was wearing a mask.
Who knows?
Philip Seymour Hoffman. He's actually dead. So
Yeah. Okay. But you know, there's definitely not scope for it. But we will be talking about Mission Impossible and Fallout in the next episode. So do stay tuned for that. I'm Simon Colum. I will be on Twitter at Screen Insight.
And I'm Joe Gudgeon, at JoeGudgeon30.
And feel free to email at hello@culturefly.co.uk.
Warning,